Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good afternoon, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Thanks a lot for joining us today. It's an interesting topic as we're kind of tickling on during the pre-show conversation. It's reaching back, but it's looking forward too. If you look at what is used to be hidden in the back room with the crazy lady is now coming to the front of a lot of our publications, discussions of IRBMs, ICBMs, long-range counter-air requirements. It's amazing how things can come around to topics that you thought you left behind a long time ago, a topic we hit on a regular basis here that in this line of work, Vince Lombardi and fundamentals are important, and you can forget about things, but that doesn't mean that reality is going to forget about you. And we have a great topic today that we're going to touch on again, and we got just the guest to bring back on. A lot of y'all already know him as a previous guest and also the work that he's done online and in a professional sense. Our guest will be Will Dossal, Captain, United States Navy, retired. He's a former E2C NFO with over 3,500 hours and 525 traps in the E2 and other things attack air-wise. He spent 26 years in active duty, and he's held a number of Navy and Joint Operational Staff positions, both afloat and ashore, including a VAW Squadron Commanding Officer, Navigator on Big Deck Carriers, and Deputy Director for Strategy and Policy, Navy Planner, and also Reconnaissance Systems Officer. He's currently employed as a senior analyst with one of the big boys in the defense world, and he's been heavily involved in policy on the operational side for the topics we really want to touch up today, and that's ballistic and cruise missile defense for the last 7 years. Will, welcome back to Midrats.
Hey, glad to be back, and welcome from a sultry midsummer Northern Virginia afternoon.
Well, at least you have your power back, so you're no longer in the 1920s again.
True, very true.
It's kind of like what we were talking about before the show started. It's very interesting. If you had Lieutenant J.G. Van Winkle, who knocked off to a long sleep in the late 80s and woke up today and picked up a couple of our professional periodicals, it's amazing what would be finding itself for him to read. Some of the names haven't even changed. Discussions of the proliferation and challenge provided by not just ICBMs, but IRBMs, short-range ballistic missiles, the proliferation of anti-ship cruise missiles. We even have, of course, a Chinese manufacturer now, but the vision of regiment-sized backfire airborne threat against our carriers, and a lot of the terms that people are talking about as if it's sexy and new and, oh my goodness, what do we do with it, this anti-access, anti-denial, that was something that the gray hairs dealt with as JOs. We kind of pushed it off to the side during the 90s, but the threat really never went away. Some of the names are the same, but modernized. We also have some new things out there, both from an offensive and a defensive point of view, that I think we've started to see more and more attention played to. So it kind of really plays into your game a bit to see some things coming back to the front.
Yeah, in a sense, it's kind of like that old song, "Everything Old is New Again." We have, in a sense, sort of come full circle, but there are some important differences as well between, say, the late 80s and where we are today. And if I could take just a minute here and throw out sort of a general characterization of the, in quotes, the threat as we view it from our bunkers today. The biggest difference is that whereas there were certain capabilities, not to mention capacities, that were reserved to the superpowers, Russia and Soviet Union and the U.S. back in the 80s, today we find near-peer nations, major regional powers, and even non-state actors are getting their hands on these capabilities. The threat is growing in numbers. It's growing in capability. It's also growing in survivability. The number of nations or the number of actors out there, if you will, that have watched very closely as the U.S. and its allies have put on a well-attended seminar, if you will, on breaking down and entering denied territory has given them pause to think. And they know that they're not going to be able to go head-to-head with us in those areas where we have pretty well demonstrated strengths, in particular for our air and most of our naval forces. So they look for where the weaknesses are. And they figure out what those weaknesses are, and they develop leapfrog technologies and assassin's mace-type weapons to take advantage of those vulnerabilities.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the growth industry, where the growth industry has been. As we, as Sal was saying, we started out back in the old days when I was a young pup, worried about the big guns of the Soviet Union, and to a certain extent, lesser extent, China. Now China seems to have come to the fore, but we've got Iran and some other people out there. India comes to mind, developing some pretty sophisticated systems. What else should we look at, now that the world has spun a few times?
Well, probably the biggest thing is the survivability of these systems. One of the things, when you look across Iran, North Korea, China, some of the singular features that you'll find with systems there on the survivability front is going to be that they're mobile. They are supported by hardened, deeply buried facilities, which will screen them from our persistent ISR and interdiction capabilities, and will in turn induce a greater degree of uncertainty on our part as to numbers, intention, and capabilities. The second thing to look for is the proliferation. Now, all those nations that you mentioned, there's, again, this certain commonality of a proliferation of technology. I'll come back to that in a minute. And the third thing is, what is the legal regime? And I know Eagle One, this is one that I think you'll be particularly interested with here, is that there is a whole branch and sequel, if you will, that has grown out of the INF Treaty that back in the 1980s we didn't envision. Everybody was going around doing high fives when we signed the INF Treaty saying, terrific, we have just banned an entire class of weapons. And to review real quick, the INF Treaty did away with ground-launched ballistic missiles, ground-launched cruise missiles with ranges that were between 1,000 kilometers and 5,500 kilometers. So while everybody was busy going around high-fiving about this, about a decade and a half later, China began working quietly and then very assiduously on developing, guess what, medium-range ballistic missiles and intermediate-range ballistic missiles to take care of the threats around her periphery, most notably India, to a lesser degree Russia, and of course looking at how to reach out and touch U.S. forces that were stationed around the region there. In addition to that, when you look at proliferation from a cruise missile standpoint, much of the technology that's gone into that, improvements in satellite navigation that you find on your desk, on your dashboard, GPS, a lot of that technology goes into the improved sat-nav units that go into cruise missiles. So now you have cruise missiles that not only have extended range but more accuracy, and along with that, some pretty wicked terminal capabilities. And when you look at what Russia and India are doing together as a joint venture, that's a model that we need to watch very closely for what develops in the next 5 to 10 years as well. So lots of vectors there to run down and take a look.
You know, it's, you mentioned the, you know, cruise missiles, and of course the anti-ship cruise missile. I remember as a kid, you know, the big boogeyman that everybody looked at, and it is ironic that we're looking back, you know, decades here, of course, but the supersonic anti-ship cruise missile, and, you know, there are other ones beside it, but the everybody thinks of the SSN-22 Sunburn. And I remember the big discussion, well, what do we do with it? And the whole key was, well, you don't get hit by it. You know, shoot the Archer, not the arrow, so to speak. But I think there's a tyranny of distance now that everybody, we have to get closer and closer and closer. And like the Israelis saw with the INS Hainet, how you pronounce it, you know, the closer you get to shore, even if you're dealing with a subsonic anti-ship cruise missile, there is no luxury in time there in order to react. There's some new things out there that make the initial issue SSN-21 Sunburn itself look very basic. But when you look at what we have on our side of the equation for a similar capability, it's just simply not there. Are we a little bit behind the curve on appreciating this challenge and rising to it? Are we a little late to the game? Or considering other priorities, do you think that we have a good focus on that particular supersonic anti-ship cruise missile, not only threat, but it wouldn't be too bad of a technology to have for ourselves?
Well, yeah, and that's where you have to sort of step back for a minute and look at where, for example, where the Navy's been for the last almost two decades, where the principal focus has shifted from sea control to projecting power ashore. A lot of the capabilities that we had for long-range strike folded very neatly back in the 80s into long-range sea control. I mean, I remember doing 1,000 nautical mile strikes with harpoon-armed A-6s and A-7s, supported by, again, B-52s coming out from CONUS, loaded to the gills with harpoons. Give me that and a couple of LAs in company, and there was no way a Slava was going to get a salvo off. Today, though, as we look out at what the emerging competitors are, you kind of have to step back for a minute and say, well, wait a minute. Do we need to be spending time, money, resources, if you will, on replicating what's going on supersonic cruise missile side of the house? Because what is the threat that's facing us? Well, the threat that's facing us is primarily coming from submerged platforms, mobile land-based systems, and air-launched cruise missiles. And when you look at each one of those three, you have to stop and think, well, what are the best ways to counter those? And that's when you have to start looking at a variety of kinetic and non-kinetic solutions. It's all too easy to focus on the kinetic, and I will tell you from what I'm looking at and what many others are looking at that lies just over the horizon with the hypersonic threat, we are, I think, rapidly entering the end game, or the end, if you will, of chemical-based weapons, missiles, guns, et cetera, in dealing with the hypersonic threat. So do we need to build an SSN-22 equivalent? No. But at the same time, we need to reconstitute our long-range sea control capabilities, our long-range war at sea capabilities, and all the all the support that goes along with that, because in turn that's going to give us a better opportunity to survive in the air-sea battle as we approach denied territory.
Well, let me make sure I understand what you're saying. You think that the chemically driven weapons are on their way out to be replaced by, I assume, electromagnetic weapons and other weapons that are in a different spectrum, like lasers and other weapons like that. Is that right?
I think we're going to have to look very seriously at that. And let me give you a scenario. Let's suppose you have a sub that's 65, 70 miles from Battle Group Center, and it pops off a hypersonic cruise missile. So now you're looking at something with a, you know, let's even look at the low end of the hypersonic range, Mach 7 to Mach 10, which if you look at what's being worked on out there today, is feasible within, I'd say, the next five to eight years. Look at your time-distance equation with that. For a Mach 10 missile closing 65 nautical miles.
As a SWO, I don't want to look at that number.
Yeah, because basically what's going to happen is it's going to get inside the sensor-to-shooter decision loop. And by the time that the sensors have detected that there's a threat out there, it's inbound, assign a weapon, get the weapon launched, the good old-fashioned chemical-fired rockets, by the time they boost, you'll be getting something through the superstructure.
Well, we're already there. I agree with you. The problem, I'm a big fan of the railgun concept. I think most people can see through the mist where the technology will take us there. Energy weapons with the right atmospherics, and again, if we can go through the right technology, it's going to be there. But even if it does go to where it needs to be, it'll be decades down the road before you reach a saturation point of having those type of weapons in the fleet. But when you look at 2012 to 2018, we have what we have when it comes to somebody getting close enough to actually take a pop at us. And isn't it true that most of our defenses that we have against cruise missiles are at best adequate for the generation we grew up with, which were the subsonic? When you get to that later Soviet technology and afterwards, our defenses really haven't, because we've been focused elsewhere, amongst other things, we're already there from that ability to react in a timely manner, especially, and I'll bring this up again in a later question because I'd love to talk about it, but what you brought in right there is we just don't have the range that we used to have, so we have to bring our high-value units closer and closer to the areas we want to be able to create effects in.
Yeah, or the alternative is you hold them out of there until that you've secured the space, which then you have to start questioning the utility of those platforms to begin with.
Exactly.
But again, one of the things, even with supersonic weapons, there is still certain phases of the flight that that they're vulnerable in, not just to kinetic, but also to non-kinetic measures. And that's where a little bit, well, not a little bit, a whole lot of the ethos and the attitudes that were present back in the 80s, that whole culture that we had back then, needs to be reconstituted. And this is one of the things that I frequently talk about with the young O4s and O5s that work with me in my day job. I tell them, sometimes to a little bit of an eye roll on their part, but I relate things like in 1981 when we took when Jerry Tuttle took the Ike Battle Group up into the North Atlantic and joined up with Forrestal and I think it was the Ark Royal. It was the first deployment for the Sea Harriers before the Falklands. And we were going to the Bear's Lair. And leaving Norfolk, which, by the way, was a bit of a It's a deceptive departure. And as soon as we passed Chesapeake Light, we put an E-2 airborne around the clock, and we commenced MCON operations, total MCON operations, for the next 22 days. You ask anybody, well, how long? What's the longest that you've done MCON ops today? And they will talk to you in terms of, oh, geez, a couple hours, and we were really hurting at the end of that.
It is funny to hear that, isn't it?
It is. But other things, too, you know, just the whole range of deceptive operations, OPSEC, looking at ways that you can seduce the open ocean surveillance systems that support the cruise missiles, and, oh, by the way, by extension, the anti-ship ballistic missiles that are out there. You know, how can you get into their decision-making process, and how can you induce uncertainty as to locating data? I mean, we induced so much uncertainty in the part of the Soviets that they were pretty much flushing their entire bear force to go out and look for us, and it took them quite some time to find us. Even while they were out looking for us, though, I always had a section of F-14s tied onto them, well outside 300, 400 nautical miles, and that just drove them absolutely batshit. It's kind of fun, actually.
Eagle One?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of situations. I mean, we already talked about the Israeli ship that got struck apparently by a Syrian missile, perhaps loaned to Hezbollah. I mean, it seems like we've got, once again, you talked earlier about layers, you know, the upper tier countries and then the lower tier. But now with the distribution of some of these weapons, availability of them throughout even countries that don't have much in the way of, or non-state actors that don't have much in the way of infrastructure, it seems to me that our targeting issues or our defense issues have gotten much more complicated than they were 20 years ago, say.
Now, there was a little bit of hubris on the part of the Israelis. When you go back and pull the thread on the Hanet, and without going into too much detail, there's similarities between that and what happened with the Sheffield. But the fact of the matter is, if you're in visual range along the coast, you are a target, and you can be hit, and you probably will be hit. And that's something that the Israelis, ironically, when you look back, the first cruise missile sinking was the Israeli destroyer Elat back in 1967. So, you know, there's an interesting story there too about institutional hubris. They've got the same issue, and when you look at what happened later on that same year in their encounter with Hezbollah, and the fact that they now consider Hezbollah to actually be a pretty well-organized military, professional military, that has changed their methodology and their means of operation against them.
The Israeli experience, and I got a copy of the PowerPoint. I don't think a lot of people have seen it. It's a kind of a nice unclassified post-ex of that engagement that brings up the a couple of really neat things about, you know, signature reduction on your ships, and, you know, having a good crane is both a good thing and a bad thing depending upon how you look at it. But the I think it folds in real well because some comments the CNO made recently in an article over in Proceedings. He showed a little bit of ankle about, you know, we talk about institutional hubris, about some of the law of diminishing returns when it comes to stealth. A lot of people think if something is stealthy, it all of a sudden has this magical Klingon cloaking device on it. And it really doesn't. And there reaches a point, and the CNO showed a little bit of ankle that I think everybody needs to be very, very careful how they talk about. But I thought he used some broad enough brushes that it kind of opened a door for an invitation for people to talk about that mathematics and technology continues to develop, and you can't classify mathematics, you can't classify technology when you can string four or five PlayStation 3s together and have a cray computer from the 1980s, that stealth is not perhaps worth as much of the sacrifice and opportunity cost that you do whether you're in the air, on the sea, or underwater. And that we need to be looking a little closer at that to make sure that mathematics and technology doesn't take away a shield that we've been relying on. Have we kind of overemphasized stealth a bit too much, or are we getting to the point that we can better balance what you can gain by both passive and active signature reduction versus what we get up that we may need, whether we're talking about range or payload or things of that manner?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a good analog to the stealth issue, and that's go back to the 1950s and look at the development of fighters, starting with the Century series. You start with the F-100, the first supersonic fighter, and what was the quest? What was the end-all, be-all? It was speed. And as you progress from the F-100 to the F-102 to the F-104, the F-105, and the F-106, you were seeing progressive leaps in speed, but were they really capable fighters? And when we got to Vietnam, and don't even get me started about the guns versus no guns debate, but when we got to Vietnam, which was barely a decade, which started barely a decade after the sort of the height of the Century series development, where was the F-104? Where was the F-106? The F-105 was being employed, but in a different manner than what it had been planned for, and was starting to suffer some pretty high losses. But really, the only two really that showed up from that series was the F-100 and the F-105. The F-4, which really turned into the workhorse of the Vietnam War, wasn't as fast, but it was a great multi-role aircraft. And we sort of carried some of that lesson forward into the 70s and the 80s. And today, speed, while important, isn't the end-all, be-all when you look at aircraft design. Similarly speaking, I think stealth needs to be given a very hard look. When you look at what happened with the A-12, much of that can be laid at the doorstep of a complete kowtow to the need for stealth. Lots of the issues with the F-22 that delayed its production can be wrapped back into stealth. Ditto with the F-35, and there's a whole host of other issues with that as well. If you can find a way to still reduce your signature without compromising performance, and when I talk about compromising performance, I'm talking about the whole range, maneuverability, and ability to, it comes a point when you need to expeditiously exit a fight as well and not get followed. So all of those, and still be able to employ a weapon system that keeps the pilot or the air crew fully enabled and fully aware of their battle space. So, and I think the same thing could be wrapped back into discussions about ships and stealth as well.
You want?
Yeah, I want to wander back to the to a certain extent to the missile problems. And I'm sitting here looking at some pieces you've written on what Iran is up to, and I'm thinking along the lines of, as you mentioned, the aircraft issues. I'm thinking along the lines of what Colonel Boyd came up with, and why the F-16 and the F-15 differed so significantly from the earlier fighter aircraft. is there the need for us to do a similar Boyd type analysis of our responses to the potential missile threat, or are we already down that path, and what we see developing is a result of that thinking?
I think we're sort of on the cusp of that, and I see this from again sort of my daily work as we look at. By sort of a theater by theater review of the situation, review of the threat. How are we going to counter that threat? Maintain what we need to do in that theater with, let's face it, decreasing resources. And I'll tell you that it is forcing folks to, again, look beyond just the kinetic. And I guess if you were to talk about a Boydian analysis of how do we approach missile defense, that's probably what it would wrap back to, is an understanding, an evolving understanding that, holy cow, we're not going to be able to rely on just the kinetic solution to this. When you look at the Iranian inventory, you're talking hundreds of missiles. We're not talking about just hundreds of Scuds. We're talking about hundreds of medium-range ballistic missiles. We're talking Shahab 3s to the Seychelles. We're talking about a nation that understands ballistic missiles and their application. There's an interesting thing about Iran. Let me just digress here for a second, that I think a lot of people have lost sight of. During the Iran-Iraq War, during an eight-year period, there were over, let's see if I remember this right now, 14.5 million Iranians were, one form or another, subjected to the impact or the effects of a ballistic missile attack, whether that was experiencing it firsthand in person through injury or losing relatives, or just the fact that I was in a part of Tehran that had to be evacuated because of a potential ballistic missile attack, and that we didn't know if the Iraqis were going to fire a conventional warhead or a chemical warhead because they'd shown a proclivity to do both. We're talking about a country that went from zero capability in 1985, zero capability, to 5 months later launching the first Scuds against Iraq, notably with the help of the Syrians and buying some Scuds from Libya. That's important. And if you want a comparison basis, go back and look at do a comparison between the V2 attacks in World War II against the populace of London, Antwerp, and some of the forward staging areas that we had on the continent. I think you're looking at about 11,000 attacks, and out of that, there were some 4,000 that were killed and 11,000 that were wounded in the Iran-Iraq War, with about 800-some-odd ballistic missile attacks. And I'm talking everything from large-caliber, long-range rockets to, like the Frog class, up through Scuds. About 2,500 killed and about 11,000 wounded. And again, 14.5 million people that, in one way or another, had some part of their life touched by ballistic missiles. So if you take that and you look at what Iran's doing now, where they're building a ballistic missile force that is at once viewed as a conventional deterrent against Israel and against the United States for taking unilateral action against them, and should deterrence fail, can be employed in structured and or salvoed attacks against countries in the region and against Israel as well. They get it.
I think one thing that's interesting about the ballistic missile challenge. And it's funny that you should mention the V-1 and V-2 series of attacks on World War II. The calculus there, in many respects, has not changed at all. And I look at it from this point of view, that if you're going to use these weapons, the advantage was then and is now, and also the weaknesses, is in the offensive. For instance, the reason why the Brits and Montgomery were so pushing the plan that they wanted to post Normandy is they knew the only way they were going to stop the attacks on the UK was from a soldier on the ground handling a gun. And if you look at the ballistic missile threat, whether you want to call it a bug or a feature, there was a flag officer the other day bragging about when he was a kid, and it was very complicated on a carrier deck because you had this multitude of different classes of aircraft, and now we have an almost exclusively multi-role light fighter flight deck, emphasis on light. We don't have the range to reach the launch spots. So if somebody's going to use these, and they're of an appreciable range, you know, how do you get to them? How do you defend from the numbers that you just mentioned? There are only so many VLS cells available. Ground-based is limited at that. We can talk about chemical-based and energy-based defenses, but that's all theoretical right now and really doesn't help us in the next half decade to decade. So with that threat that you outlined, if somebody did want to use it, is there an appreciation out there of the effects that would have, again, going back to World War II, the tactical effects on the ground aren't the issue. It's the impact on the civilian population. Is that something else that we're relearning and thinking about again, or have we just really not scratched the surface of that aspect of it?
I think it depends on where you're talking about. I think the Israeli population, for example, certainly gets it because they, while the numbers weren't there like they were in the Iran-Iraq War, they certainly had their experience at the receiving end of some Scuds and a daily dose of Kassan and other large caliber rockets that end up coming in from either from Lebanon or from the Gaza Strip. And they fully understand that they need to do more than just try and do an active defense. Iron Dome and some others being an example of that. When you pull back from it and you look at, okay, well, what constitutes ballistic missile defense? And you could say, really, that what constitutes BMD at this point almost would wrap back into the whole integrated air missile defense. You've got three pillars that you're looking at. You have passive defense, active defense, and then attack operations. And if we take those in sort of reverse order, attack operations is probably the oldest in the book. Operation Crossbow in World War II, for a 8-month period, took up almost 50% of the strategic and tactical bombing assets on the part of the Allies to try and interdict the V-1 and the V-2. The net effect of that was, at the end of that 8 months, the first V-2 attack started on London. Jump up to the Desert Shield, Desert Storm. There was an A-10 assigned to a Scud kill box, which was mapped across, all the way across Iraq. One A-10 per kill box, 24/7. There were special forces inserted specifically to try and find and kill the TELs, the transport director launchers that were being used for the Scuds. We devoted enormous numbers of reconnaissance assets that could have been used elsewhere to try and find these things. The net effect of that entire campaign was there were no launchers struck, zero. And we still ended up with the largest single casualty event of Desert Shield, Desert Storm was when the Scud landed in the temporary barracks in a warehouse. So there's challenges on the attack operation side of the house, and anybody that will tell you, that tries to tell you, that, oh, well, you know, we'll just take care of this by, you know, hitting the missiles on the ground before they launch, is a fool, plain and simple. When you look at, again, I mentioned earlier about the hardened, deeply buried facilities, that's a universal constant across, really, around the world. China, North Korea, Iran, they understand this, and they have extensive UGFs to support their ballistic missiles. That's going to be a tough nut to crack.
Yeah, the Germans, in spite of all the attack, the Germans were building V-2s up to the day that American GI kicked into the door to their cave.
Exactly. But one of the things that made it difficult to use those missiles is when the chemical pipeline for the production of the fuel got interrupted. So you have to be smart about how do you go about doing attack operations. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to go out and kill tails. It could well mean that you go out and maybe malware to take down the command and control system so they can't launch. So that's one pillar. Another pillar is passive defense. If you're country A, let's say, and all of your electrical grid funnels through a single point in your country, what do you think is going to be a prime target for country B's short-range ballistic missiles? It's going to be that juncture. So if you can distribute key infrastructure, whether it's power, transportation, government, if you can get that distributed, enlarge the target base, if you will, such that you complicate their decision-making, their strike planning, to the point where a certain degree of uncertainty is instituted that a massive strike won't necessarily take out the or have the desired effect in terms of taking down the grid, taking down transportation, taking down parts of the government, and compelling the country A to concede and to give up. Then you have some success there. All of that folds into assisting in debriding an attack so that when you move to the third pillar of active defense, now you can start working at knocking down, identifying and knocking down missiles that are headed for key facilities. You're never going to be able to defend 100% of a territory. You're most likely going to have to accept some impacts. But if you can take out portions of the strike that are headed for key facilities, then you may have a fighting chance there. Does that sort of all make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense, although one of the issues, which I don't think we've discussed much, is the detection of the... I mean, you have to be able to detect before you can respond, and you have to be able to use the information you've gathered from your detection to be able to target. I know that we have space tracking and surveillance system demonstrators up there, and I gather we're using X-band radar for some of this stuff. But are those capable of being integrated into a targeting system to help us take out, certainly in the long range, things that would missiles that would be a threat to our home country? And what are we doing on the short range stuff? Some of those are going to have awfully short flight times to deal with.
Oh, yeah, well, they all are. We already are there. We have, beginning with Homeland Defense, you have an integrated system that has been online since 2006, really, that originally was put in place for limited attacks out of Northeast Asia to the continental U.S. As you look at, as you take it down into the theaters, there are elements of that system that provide the launch alert, indications of warning, to theater systems, cue those systems so that they, in turn, can start providing tracking information to Aegis ships, Aegis BMD ships, THAAD batteries, and Patriot batteries for a mid-course or an in-game solution. And that, in part, is behind the whole phased adaptive approach that we see being instituted first in Europe. It is a it's a viable, it's a workable approach.
I have a question for you. The just kind of shifting things a bit. When one thing we really haven't seen, really since the Vietnam War, is a very challenging counter air environment for our attack air. You know, having the Taliban throw up AAA and some old SAMs was one thing. Iraq, we had them figured out. Libya, the operation was kind of a live fire exercise in many respects. You know, some of it looks like they're a combination of we're pretty good and who we've been going against are pretty bad. When you look at what some new stuff out there that we really haven't been challenged with, you know, the S-400 comes to mind, but there's some pretty impressive counter-air kit out there that our aviators may face at some point down the road. What systems out there do you think present the largest challenge to us should we face them, and what could people relay them to and as far as U.S. or allied systems would be?
Wow. Well, let's see. In certain environments, we face both a qualitative and a quantitative aspect. You know, who was it, Stalin that said numbers are a quality in their own? There comes a point where your fifth-generation fighter, if you can get all of your fifth-generation fighters up and online, they are presented with a target-rich environment such that they could go Winchester in a few minutes and still have lots of stuff blowing through that line. So you got a challenge there in terms of numbers. You have, yes, things like the S-300s, the S-400s. The S-400 hasn't really been proliferated yet, knock on wood. The S-300s, you're seeing them out there. It's going to be tough. And I think slowly folks are coming around to this realization that we've had it easy, really, for the last decade and a half. And in that time frame, many of the resources that we would envision using in such a future engagement are getting very long in the tooth. Let's talk about one of those vulnerabilities. For all the great fifth-generation fighters and strike aircraft we have, they need airborne refueling. What's the general age of the KC-135 fleet? Where does the KC-135, KC-10 operate from? Are those airfields within range of intermediate-range ballistic missiles? Would those missiles be used against those airfields? And it wouldn't necessarily have to take out the entire airfield. What is the time to reconstitute a POL farm that's been taken out, to rebuild it and restock it, and at the same time replace whatever aircraft may have been damaged on the ramp? You don't necessarily need a full kill, or to, in other words, take all the tankers out. if you have just enough damage that we're going to be without land-based tanker support for, oh, I don't know, let's say 3 days. That's just a wild guess. What does that do to your theater air plan? What does that do to your long-range strike plan? What does that do to the air wing, which has become so beholden now to land-based tankers, since we have done a very efficient job at eliminating the long-range, long-durability tankers that we used to have on board as part of the air wing? As you correctly pointed out earlier, we've gone to a very nice light strike fighter air wing, not to put too fine a point to it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about why Russia is so opposed to the anti-ballistic missile installations that we've talked about in Eastern Europe and in the Black Sea area.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason the Russians are PO'd about it is because there are Americans on the ground and the near beyond, areas that they consider to be their territory, even though it's no longer part of the greater Soviet empire. We, the United States, have gone to excruciating, and let me underscore that, excruciating pains to point out to them in any one of a number of technical forums the fact that the PAA is not a threat to the Soviet strategic deterrent, both in terms of numbers and just sheer capabilities. The SM-3, in whatever form, whether we're talking about the current Block 1A off of the BMD ships, the Block 1B, which is the first of the Aegis Ashore missiles to be installed, or the Block 2 variants that are to come. Those, by the nature of the way the BMDS is set up, will end up in a tail chase against any Soviet strategic missile. Let me see if I can run you through a scenario here. The thing you have to remember about a BMDS, about the U.S. BMDS system, is that you can't start calculating a weapon solution until you've reached booster burnout. Because at that point, now you can say from this point and use ballistic calculations to say, here is the general area of uncertainty that the RV or RVs are going to land in. And so now I can start calculating what the true ballistic trajectory and where my intercept points might be. Well, the problem is when you start looking at Soviet launches, I'm sorry, Russian launches, boy, am I showing my my early bias here.
It happens to the best of us.
It starts getting to be too hard to do. If you look at a let's say a short burn threat, because that's a counter BMD capability, is that you don't burn your booster as long as you might normally burn it. So let's say 130 seconds from launch to booster burnout. Now you're looking at probably about anywhere from a minute to 2 to 3 minutes after burnout to build enough of a target solution, a targeting solution, that you can launch the SM-3. By the time that the SM-3 launches and it goes through its burnouts and KV deployment, kinetic kill vehicle deployment, that's another 280 seconds. And by this point, the Russian missiles are well over the horizon. That's just looking at a straight matchup. When you look at the reality of launches from the westernmost missile fields in Russia and the easternmost if you look at the whole range of the trajectories from those launch fields to the U.S., they don't pass anywhere near any of the current or projected Aegis Ashore locations. And, oh, by the way, any of the current or projected Aegis Afloat locations. So, again, it is extremely disingenuous on the part of the Russians, but it's a convenient one that they can pound on, because so many people don't understand, you know, frankly, the science behind ballistic missile defense. And you can easily coerce them with drawings that are not correct or drawings that are skewed to try and show your point of view, but don't meet the realities of the situation. They want the bottom line is they want the U.S. Presence out of the former East European bloc. They want the U.S. out of the Black Sea.
Yeah, it's really domestic politics and just Russians being Russians. It's reassuring and predictable, but kind of frustrating as well. And speaking of frustrating, we talk about Aegis Ashore and all these great plans for ballistic missile defense with our radars and everything else. And it's all in Europe. But the Europeans, if you combine continental NATO Europe, they have a GDP greater than ours and a population greater than ours. But it's U.S. systems that are going in. Is the Europeans' lack of ability to do this, is it from the habit of, well, Uncle Sam will do it so we don't have to? Or do they just not as energized about the threat as they, from our point of view, should be?
A little bit of each, and again, from my daily interactions, both with U.S. and with NATO, that's coming around. There's a lot that doesn't make it up into the public sphere of discussion, but the bottom line is that the key countries in Europe, Britain, Germany, France, and the Dutch certainly get it, even the Spaniards, understand the threat and are looking at what technologies they can develop in-house to contribute to to build into a larger regional system. Now, naturally, that's going to raise a whole lot of interesting issues. If you recall, during the Cold War, there was the whole question about, well, who really has the trigger, the finger on the trigger of the nukes in Germany? The whole dual key thing. Will there be similar arrangements in terms of the defense of Europe? And the reason, again, I go back to the primary reason why we were looking at Europe to first put in this system is when you look at the trajectories coming out of northwest Iran towards the northeast U.S., that is why you have sites that are going up in Romania, and the second site will be going up in Poland, and why you have a BMDS radar at Fylingdales in England, why we've upgraded the early warning radar at Thule, and why there has been a lot of work devoted to looking at how we do an over-the-shoulder shot, if you will, from the GBIs up in the Alaska field. With those systems in place, in just from a sensor standpoint, if you forget about a kinetic response out of the Romania site, because that's not there yet, you still have some limited coverage of the continental U.S. With GBIs and the string of sensors from Turkey through through Europe and on through Greenland, that would give you a medium probability shot out of Alaska. Now, you add in a mid-course interceptor like an SM-3 Block 1 Bravo out of Romania, and you've just debrided the attack. When you go to the SM-3 Block 2B and you have an engage on remote capability, now you're talking ability to get the really long-range stuff headed for the U.S., coming out of, say, Iran or someplace else there in the Middle East, with a pretty fair degree of a probability of kill. The problem with this all, of course, goes back to numbers then, too. So when you look at the numbers that are likely to come out of that kind of a raid, they're certainly much lower than what you would expect to see out of a Russian or Chinese strategic strike, which is one of the reasons why we emphasize today that Russia's, and not quite as much emphasis, but still there, China's strategic force is not considered to, the GBIs and such are not considered to be used against those forces or to be deployed against those forces.
Well, this has been a very fast hour, and I've got about, I don't know, 3 hours more worth of questions for you. But we've running out of time on the show, so could you, I know you've got your Steel Jaw Scribe blog site. What else can we be looking for you to be doing here in the next few weeks and or months? What's on your agenda, and what, where can we find more of your work?
Well, certainly there. Let's see. I would also commend the BMD chapter in the book that was a group of us put together back and published back in 2010, Securing Freedom in the Global Commons. If you want sort of a basic primer on BMD, as well as a number of other capabilities and approaches to how do we defend the commons, I would, again, certainly recommend that book, and it is available on Amazon.com. Working on the initial research design and putting together a small team to for another book, this one on integrated air missile defense from a historical perspective, looking at IMD and the Navy from before World War II up through the present. So you're looking at going from the early days of visual spotters, trying to train individual guns from the decks of ships to engage on remote over the horizon ballistic missile defense simultaneous with naval integrated fires. So it's still very much in the embryonic stage. Myself and a partner in crime who's a surface warfare officer have been kicking this around for some time. He just retired for good, and said, let's go back and take a look at this and see what we can do to get something on the streets.
Well, it sounds like really good gainful employment, and thanks a lot for joining us this Sunday afternoon.
My pleasure, and hey, I've really enjoyed it. We got to do this more often.
I agree. Good congenial conversation.
You're invited back anytime.
And all our people that are alive have dropped off the audio, but the good ones are coming back to catch the extra few minutes on archive. I'd like to thank everybody for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Look forward to seeing you again soon. Until then, hope you have a great Navy Day.
Good night.
That's all, and thanks again.
Molly wrote on me to reply to Irish Paddy, saying, my Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave this friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, Leicester Square.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.